were filming Half Hanson up at Marietta near Sacramento, one of the national sports channels, and they had him wear a microphone, a portable one like mine, while he was writing. First time ever, and they had him say, "I'm approaching jump number one," and it's pretty hard, and he had to describe his ride as he went. As an aside, he won. But in the process, this national sports channel said to him, "Don't tell Dr. Scott about you wearing this microphone, or you'll be wearing one all the time." I'm going to send him a telegram and say, under separate cover is the microphone you're to wear all through Europe. The interesting part is they all watch. And I don't know if you've noticed, you're seeing a lot more horses on television than you used to see. Eastbourne and the Grand Prix circuit is about where golf was 15, 20 years ago. How many of you are old enough to remember when they used to play golf for $20,000 and $30,000, $35,000 and $50,000 purses? Now, that wouldn't even cover first prize. And more, we have pioneered, and you have, by your response, shown the networks that people enjoy watching horses. Saturday Night Live, the old Saturday Night Live, used to record the festival every night. It was kind of like a coat, that's like it's got horns. It used to record the festival every night, listen to it the next afternoon. There's a catalyst to give ideas. How many of you noticed that remember several years ago when I was teaching on the pyramid, you remember how many pyramid teachers emerged all of a sudden? Channel 40 was taking tours to the pyramid. And everywhere you turned, you're reading the religious ads, somebody teaching on the pyramid. Then you notice it all stopped. They caught up to where I taught them, and they didn't know. They didn't know where else to go. Remember when I was teaching the series on prophecy in the Book of Revelation, and everybody's teaching on prophecy? I ruined their plans when I just stopped. They didn't know where to go next. And you notice, the recent Indiana Jones movie with the returning to the religious matrix and the search for the Holy Grail is getting a lot better response than that stupid Temple of Doom nonsense. But again, they should have consulted me on the ending. It's like a great movie. They just carried it right to the end and they didn't know what in the hell to do with it. So let this poor old guy that stand there waving his hand and the cup down in the crack and Indiana Jones and Sean Connery and the broad. Going through the final drama and the broad getting her just due and Indiana and his dad get some kind of milquetoast ending to what was a great movie up to that point. I didn't finish teaching on the Holy Grail. Remember that? Bill Chandler came to me about 2 years ago and asked if I would be a consultant with him on this recent Star Trek one on the ending, and I said, "Well, I'm willing to consider it." And we talked about it, and I went my way, and he went his way, and then he saw me recently and said, I'm really sorry we didn't get together, Gene, but our production process made us go ahead and finish. I haven't seen it yet. But I'll give you my opinion when I see it. I'm telling you, the ultimate issues that we deal with here are issues that deep down every thinking person wants to consider somewhere along his life's journey. And as I return to the pyramid teaching again, I bet you we'll see a lot of people start up again. Now, there's a side to me that makes me want to come right to the same point again and quit. But for your sake, if you're faithful and stay with the task, and when the music plays, get on the phone and let me know you're there, and the regulars who know exactly what you should be doing and your faithfulness each month, get on the phone and deliver your messages, I can keep going without interruption. I would like to finish tying all the loose ends together. It has never been my fault when I quit. And it, I think, is more apparent to people that have listened many years that these are not independent subjects. God has woven a fabric, the very synthesizing of which makes all of the elements combine more than the sum of the parts. That's the wonder of it. Most people who study Stonehenge do it in isolation, or the pyramid in isolation. And God's Word remains the missing part that can make sense of all these different independent units, and they must be seen in conjunction. The mystery of the old ley lines, the mystery of Atlantis, about which probably more books have been written than any other subject in the world, the Great Pyramid of Egypt, Stonehenge. The placement of the great cathedrals, particularly in the British Isles. The mystery which I believe Satan has tried to distort in the research in and around the south of France that brought forth the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail. The part the Templars have played in history. The Lost Tribes. Astronomy, rightly understood, starting with Virgo and ending with Leo, not the way most people started. These perform a fabric that makes the creation and history eloquently cry out the controlling hand of God, His faithfulness to His Word, and a basis on which we can rest our trust and act our faith, which is the only means by which God's salvation brings us alive into Him. That's a purpose that I'm here to teach. I'm as irritated that self-continuity functions so often have to crowd out our reason for being. And I can only believe that those that have listened over the years will one day recognize you've been called, as Jonathan's armor bearers, as the 7,000 that God had to let Elijah know had not yet bowed their knee to Baal, and will come to understand that this is a message that the world in this day needs, and together we can get it out by being faithful. Now get on the telephone. Let me know you're there before I start the teaching tonight. That's my John Boy mark. I'm not going to explain it to you anymore. I'm reading from Great Pyramid, Proof of God. On the cover, a diagram of the internal passages of the Great Pyramid. Interestingly enough, of all the pyramids in Egypt, this is the only one that has some ascending passages. It also has some ventilation ducts, which are what those lines that form the V are. So the king that intended to be buried there could breathe well. Nobody knows you build tombs like that. It's by George R. Rifert. As I told you, there is no one book. Don't go try to find one. There is no one book that will handle this subject. And I will read portions of a lot of books as I set the stage for teaching on the pyramid, the Great Pyramid of Egypt again. The Great Pyramid of Giza has been for almost 5,000 years and always will be incomparable. Knowing its character as we do today, we can almost believe that the Greeks were divinely inspired when they named it the world's greatest wonder. Their judgment abides unchallenged. Now, I've said I will point out to you the importance in God's master plan of the ages of Palestine, Egypt, and Great Britain. And I repeat what I've been repeating each night since I started on this. You have to pause and ask, why, when you realize and take the time to realize that if you take that great wonder, Stonehenge, draw a line from the northwest marker stone in a circle enclosed by the mounds, which in turn are enclosing Stonehenge, and you take the northwest marker stone and the southeast marker stone, draw a line between them, and extend that line like a rum line straight across the Mediterranean Ocean, it will hit the pyramid smack in the face. And you take the controlling triangular measurement, which those who have studied the prophetic implications of the interior passages of the pyramid call the Christ triangle, lay it butting up against the north base of the pyramid, and take the hypotenuse and center it in the north face of the pyramid and run it as a rum line through Sinai, it will hit Bethlehem smack on the dot. I remember when I was doing some preparatory work on my master's, planning to do a PhD in geography at Cal before I changed and subsequently ended up at Stanford doing a PhD in philosophies of education. I considered applying for a Fulbright scholarship to study geopolitics at the American University in Beirut. My professor said, And what it's going to do is study the geopolitics of the area of Palestine. My professor said, oh, pick an area more important to the world. The world cannot. Talk about a tiger by the tail. The world cannot ignore Palestine. In Britain, that phenomenal little country, in a skeptical world, still has the most enduring kingship existing anywhere. One of their chief strategists during the Second World War, when he came across an army regulation that disallowed anybody in their regiments under a certain height, said, with such stupid regulations, I now know that we must be the lost tribes to have survived. What is the secret of that little land that built the largest empire in the world and still has the largest community of nations interconnected the world has ever seen? Now you might say, well, what's Egypt? They can't even whip Libya. The Bible says Egypt will play a prominent part in the last days. Indeed, it will be struggles between Egypt and the Antichrist to be that will set the stage in the last days for the full revelation of Antichrist. I used to preach when people were heralding Sadat as the peacemaker, and Sadat, even as people always do in every generation, was picked by some as a potential Antichrist who'd come in with a formula of peace. That ain't the way the Bible lays it out. Egypt will be the troublemaker at the end. Egypt will be the one that stirs up Antichrist and causes the crisscrossing and the final desolation of the holy city. And into the millennium, Egypt's going to play an important role. And God has prophesied in the last days a highway that runs from Egypt into Palestine that will flow with traffic, and that there will be a monument or a witness to God in the last days at the center and the border of Egypt. There's only one place that qualifies as the center and the border of Egypt, and that's the spot where the Pyramid of Giza stands. It is not an accident that God continues to link these three places. And I'm in the business of demonstrating God's control over history. Would any be surprised to learn the Great Pyramid stands in Egypt? Hardly. That is indeed the world's enchanted land. The great of all ages and nations sooner or later find their way to this domain of mystery and marvel. I don't even think it's an accident that that great power to the north that occupies the land geographically characterized as the place of Gog and Magog of last days, that God will bring forth and turn back with hooks in their jaw, will rise and ascend over the land that's restored Israel. It will be so destroyed in the Battle of Armageddon that there'll be a valley named as the Valley of Their Dead. And that seat of godlessness, that even after the millennium will be a seedbed for Satan, who's been bound 1,000 years and is released for a little season, will be able to find converts to his plan, foolishly willing to come and encompass the city of Jerusalem again at the end of the millennium. Not the Armageddon, which occurs just before the millennium, but the second encompassing of the city, where they'll be destroyed by fire. It is from that source that the funding has come for the great dams and the flooding of the areas of great architectural wonder to cover the truths that are hidden in Egypt, as the Nile is backed up to flood these areas reeking with history that disproves the stupid notion that man was so ignorant that it took the modern day to achieve the accomplishments we now have. Man was much smarter, as the Bible suggests, a long time ago, and got off of dumb, and we're on the way back. The great of all ages and nations sooner or later find their way to Egypt, this domain of mystery and marvel. Written into the history of Egypt are the tragedies of alien alliances and imperial romances, the rise and fall of ancient civilizations, the unsurpassed accomplishments of architecture, the beauty of art, the mysteries of science, the triumphs of war, the utter zeal, weirdness, and superstition of idolatrous religion, and strangest of all, the irrefutable evidence of a divine messianic revelation. Egypt has wielded a magnetic influence from time immemorial. Alexander the Great, after establishing a worldwide empire, retired to this fair land to enjoy his triumphs. His deep affection for Egypt was immortalized in the building of the famous city of Alexandria. He would return to Babylon to die of mysterious cause there, but it was in Egypt. He consulted the oracles, sought the secret of eternal life, and I believe became demon-possessed with that beast from the pit that will once again emerge to possess Antichrist in the last days. When informed that because of the seriousness of the fever he had contracted in the swamps of Babylon, death was near, Alexander's only request was that he might die in the land of the pharaohs. Then again, it was to Cleopatra, the royal enchantress of the Nile, that Mark Antony said, "We have kissed away kingdoms and provinces." 18 centuries later, another of the world's imperial figures wins his way to this enchanted land. He cannot conquer Europe, he feels, and wear the iron crown of empire, except he too writes his name into the history of Egypt. The year 1798 finds Napoleon Bonaparte fighting a decisive battle in the very shadows of the Great Pyramid. So profoundly involved was this land in all the crucial affairs of mankind that Egypt became not only the home of God's Israel for 400 years, but ironically also a refuge for God's only Son, our Lord, during King Herod's murder of the innocents. The scriptural prophecy, "Out of Egypt have I called my son," was therefore literally fulfilled. Napoleon Bonaparte spent a night in the king's chamber, came out the next day in such a state of shock no one could get him to reveal the experience he had therein. He left that experience to lose his dreams in the attempt to conquer Russia. Once he paled on St. Helena, where he'd been banished, as he almost told someone of his experience in the king's chamber of the pyramid, and then he refused to do it. Concerning the pyramid, our interest circles a group of wonders: Egypt itself, the Great Pyramid, and the most amazing wonder of all, that such a marvelous structure was ever built. The other six world wonders, turn me up a little, sound people. The other six world wonders over which, in the judgment of the ancient Greeks, it ranked are a matter of record: Colossus of Rhodes, Hanging Gardens of Babylon, Temple of Diana at Ephesus, Statue of Jupiter at Athens, Mausoleum at Halicarnassus, and the Pharaoh's Lighthouse at Alexandria. All of these other six wonders of the world have gone to ruins, but the Great Pyramid still stands, a veritable Gibraltar amid the storms, shocks, and wreckage of the centuries. In position, it is central to all the land area of the world. He who placed this ancient monument must have had the worldwide knowledge of a skilled surveyor. For lines drawn through the pyramid to the four cardinal points of the compass divide equally the earth's terrain. It is therefore the logical and geographical zero of longitude rather than Greenwich, England. But located as it is, just 10 miles southwest of Cairo, it is also the center of a great circle whose radius, like the spoke of a wheel, sweeps perfectly the Mediterranean shoreline of the rich fan-shaped delta of the Nile. Then, too, in accord with the scripture of Isaiah 19, verse 20, its position is central to Egypt, for it stands in the midst of the land and on the border thereof. No engineer could have selected a better site than the extended rocky plateau on which the pyramid is built. While Egypt has many pyramids, the Great Pyramid of Cheops, so-called, at Giza, is the only one having any astronomical, prophetical, or messianic significance. All the others, some quite large, are but inferior imitations of the incomparable masterpiece at Giza. Historical records give the Great Pyramid various names. The term Giza refers to the place of location. Cheops, to the king during whose reign tradition has come to believe it was erected. We challenge that, and we show and have in past teaching that the inscription, the only writing in the interior of the pyramid, is a forgery by a headline hunting explorer who planted these inscriptions to give himself notoriety, but that's another subject. Interestingly enough, in this land of heathen and idol worship, where grave after grave has been unearthed, the walls of which have markings, heathen markings of various kinds, there are no such markings inside the Great Pyramid. Cheops is also known as Shufu or Khufu, while his brother who followed him on the throne or perhaps ruled with him at the same time is known as Nimshufu. The royal marks, the cartouches of these kings, were found in two widely separated places, the Great Pyramid and Mount Sinai. In the Great Pyramid, they appear as stamped with red paint on one of the massive granite overhead beams of the king's chamber. In the Sinaitic hills, they were found engraved on a pillar of rock which overlooks the ruins of a vast iron furnace and slag banks. As said, we will demonstrate again, as we have in the past, they're a forgery. They weren't there in the original pyramid. And from that tenuous forgery, Khufu or Cheops has been credited with building this pyramid as his great and wonderful place of entombment. Having built it, he decided to be buried elsewhere. The air ducts probably kept him too cold. Cheops didn't build it. The evidence is a forgery, and the mystery remains. Who was the builder? The external Masonic splendor given to the builders of the pyramid is gone forever. What the destroying forces of nature through the centuries could not do, the vandal hand of man has done. Without, this greatest of architectural wonders has been stripped of the white polished limestone casings which was once its glory. Within, visitors of the souvenir-taking type and investigators of the baser sort have left the marks of their mutilating irreverence. Perfect granite edges have been chipped. The wonderful stone coffer or lidless chest, so symbolical of the risen Messiah, because it is empty and always was, is badly broken. Nor has the queen's chamber escaped, for there the destruction wrought by sledge and dynamite tell the tragic story of a senseless search after hidden passageways supposed to lead to treasure chambers and underground to the great Sphinx. The immensity of the pyramid can easily be given in figures. Those who've been there say there's but one way to really know it. Camp for a while close by. To see day after day its towering courses of rock rise 484 feet in the golden glow of the sun, and walk slowly around its great base sides, each 761 feet in length. Viewed from a distance, the pyramid looms dark and massive against the sky. Its four sides converge with geometrical symmetry to the 42-foot course of rock which forms its top. Just why no head or apex stone ever gathered to a point the lines of its sides is one of the great mysteries, and one we're going to explain later. A closer look shows the great step-like ledges of granite which rise 200 plus courses high. These vary in thickness, the heaviest above the base, the 35th being 50 inches. To place these huge blocks, weighing as much as 20 to 70 tons, required heavier lifting by 40,000 tons. The pyramid is of solid rock composed of granite, limestone, and sandstone sections, all cut and fitted with mathematical exactness. If measured in sacred Hebrew cubits of 25 inches, pyramid inches that is, a half a hair's breadth from the British inch and the American inch, which is 1/500,000,000 of the distance from north to south through the axes of the earth, from north to south pole. The base is 365.24 cubits square, covers 13 acres, while the four triangular sides each represent 5 acres. The dimensions of this ancient building are given in pyramid inches, or sometimes called sacred Hebrew cubits. The former is the same as our English inch with an 11/10,000ths. That is 10,011 English inches equal 10,000 pyramid inches, and of these, 25 make a sacred Hebrew cubit. Once again, tying Palestine, typical Hebrew Palestine, Egypt, and Britain together. It is this same sacred cubit, 25 pyramid inches, said pyramid inch being, I repeat, 1/500,000,000th of the distance from north to south pole along its axis. That is the measuring unit of the Ark of the Covenant, the Temple of Solomon, the pyramid in Egypt, and derivatively, Stonehenge in Britain. The pyramid's base circuit is then 4 times 9,131 inches, or 36,524 inches. The height, 5,813 inches. And the 25th course of the masonry, which is the level of the Queen's Chamber, is 1,162 inches above the baseline. So what, you might say? Well, I'll tell you in a minute. I'm reading from the Great Pyramid, Proof of God. And as I ended the previous half hour, I was reading a lot of statistics about its measurements and the precision of those measurements, the striking relationship of the figures being their importance, and I don't want your eyes to glass over with the mathematics. Let me simply say what this paragraph is saying, that contained in those various measurements are precise recognitions indicated of the three astronomically deducted years that astronomers work from and mathematicians can work from, the regular solar year, the sidereal year, and the anomalistic year. You had to have a detailed understanding of the movements of heavenly bodies, the earth in its orbit, the nature of the elliptical orbit, to be able to calculate those things, the precession of the equinoxes, and the precessional that is related to the revolving of the earth on its axis, the wobble, that has the North Star change about every 2,000 years and return to the same spot in something over 25,000 years, demanded the sophistication of astronomy not even available in the Middle Ages. Yet the builder of the pyramid permanized those specifications in its design. So perfectly was the hinged rock door giving entrance into the passageways that start with the descending passage. So perfectly was the hinged rock door constructed and hung that it was never discovered from the outside. When the Arabs broke into the interior of the pyramid, assuming that the passage would be somewhere near the middle, based upon ancient records of Egypt, they started digging in the middle. But it was displaced to the left, so they missed the opening. Proof you couldn't discover the opening from the outside, so finally hinged was this marble door. The entrance to the pyramid is in the north side, 50 feet from the pavement and 286.1 inches from the north and south line through its center. Thus, the entrance displaced and the central plane of the passageway displaced from the central plane by that 286.1 inches, about 24 feet. The descending passage, briefly shown here in the descending passage coming down from that north face, it's about 4 feet high, 3.5 feet wide, cut through the solid rock at an angle of 26 degrees plus for a distance of 345 feet. Here it levels out for 30 feet. And then terminates in a subterranean chamber, 46 feet by 27 feet, called the pit. This cavern-like room, known also as the Chamber of Chaos, is 100 feet below the base of the pyramid and varies from 1 to 14 feet in height. It has two openings, one of about 50 feet leading south to a dead end, and the other a deep well-like hole in the center of the rough floor of uncertain depth. The ascending passage begins 90 feet from the rock door opening . The junction it makes with the descending passage is sealed, however, with a granite plug 15 feet long. So tightly does this plug fit that it must have been placed before the construction of the passageway reached a higher level, which means it was always part of the plan to plug the passage. Beyond this obstruction, 130 feet about, we enter a beautiful chamber finished in white limestone, 156 feet long, about 28 feet high, and 7 foot wide, the wider upper passage. Called the Grand Gallery or the Hall of Truth and Light, its four walls converge to a ceiling 3 feet wide by means of a series of 7 overhanging courses of rock, 2 long bench-like rows of ramp stones a foot wide and high, numbering 28 on each side, are built on the floor. And already some of you are tuning in on the number 7. At the opening of the Grand Gallery, a low horizontal passage built of polished granite leads southward 102 feet to the Queen's Chamber. Horizontal, smaller passage there. It's 19 feet long. I'm reading this one because this writer translates the pyramid inches into our units just for general impression of size. It is 19 feet long, 17 feet wide, with 15 feet high, and has the peak of its gable roof exactly in the center axis of the pyramid. Notice the King's Chamber is past center. This one's right in the center, the Queen's Chamber. You want to look at it over there? Come on, Ed, take two. See it a little better there? See how the Queen's Chamber is right in the center? Follow the axes on up, Doug, to the top so you can see. Queen's Chamber apex is right in the center, whereas the King's Chamber is a bit past. The north side of the pyramid, with the entrance of the descending passage being on the right of your screen. Going back to the Grand Gallery, Ed, you move over here so you can pull camera one over and use it on the... I'll work off camera two. You work off the diagram. Going back to the Grand Gallery, focus in on that. We find an opening under part of the lower last ramp stone. See in the lower right of your screen the word first, which is first ascending passage. You see a little dotted line that drops down just below the opening of the, looks like a polywog coming down from where the horizontal passage to the Queen's Chamber takes off and the Grand Gallery opens up in the higher roof. This opening under part of the lower last ramp stone in the Grand Gallery, called the well, or well shaft. It is in reality a steep, narrow, and in places jagged shaft leading down to the through the grotto to a point in the descending passage not far from the pit. Now, interestingly enough, this displacement factor, 286.1 pyramid inches, exactly back from where the descending passage turns into the pit, 286.1 pyramid inches back is where this well shaft takes off and gives the appearance of just forcing its way or blasting its way with a little holding place called the grotto up through, and whereas most connections like the opening door are so smooth you can't see it, it literally comes into the right side of the gallery as though it's blasted its way into the Grand Gallery. And notice again, 286.1, the ascending passage opens up at exactly that same point. Again, 286.1 pyramid inches. And the entrance into the north face of the pyramid, if you'll zoom out a bit to where the descending passage starts, that entrance, which in this cross section could lend the impression enters right in the middle of the north face, is displaced exactly 286.1 pyramid inches to the left. Now, the Latin word for left is the word from which we get sinister. Off the center line, 286.1 pyramid inches. That's one of the most important numerical values and a key to the prophetic passages in the pyramid. And consistently that number shows up at exactly the places it should show up. I'm going to anticipate what we'll say later in the prophetic plan of God and on the timeline that is revealed astronomically in the pyramid, that Grand Gallery, the second ascending passage, opens up 286.1 inches at exactly on the timeline of Christ's death, when salvation for mankind was gained. The right side, as you look at the screen of that well, comes in at that point, and the left side extends a little further into the gallery, because he was in the grave 3 days and rose again. Man on a downward passage in the descending passage under the control of Thuban, the dragon star, which is anticipating things we'll talk about later, is on a downward, hopeless slide. The first ascending passage cannot be proceeded into by man's effort because it is blocked by that granite plug. And as you come down into the pit, and it turns into the subterranean chamber, the destiny of all under the control of the dragon. 286.1 pyramid inches back, the well symbolizing the work of Christ in his death and resurrection blasts through that rock and opens up in the resurrection of the grand gallery and starts the process of truth and light into what some would call the dispensation of grace, though I'm not a dispensationalist, in the march toward the king's chamber. In this prophetic plan of the pyramid, at the noonday, at a certain time of the year, you could put a mirror at the bottom of that descending passage and it would reflect Thuban and the constellation of the dragon. Zoom in on that extension of that telescope of the descending passage. Aligned to true north, the north star would shine at noonday down that passage on that same day. Scored lines where you see that, what is labeled scored lines, whereas the rest of the lines along the descending passage are vertical, these are scored as marker lines. Extend them off into the gallery of the heavens. It hits the blessed star in the neck of the bull, Alcyone, in the Pleiades. And at only one time in the procession through the heavens did they so line up, taking that as a marker point and counting 1/500,000,000th of the axes of the earth from north to south pole, which is the unit of measurement in the pyramid, and counting 1 inch to a year, counting forward from the intersection, which marks the date astronomically, when that lineup occurred, you come exactly to the date following an inch to a year on the floor of the descending passage that the Exodus came out of Egypt, which starts the first descending passage, which you have to stoop to go up. The Arabs dug around the plug. It took a miracle to break that downward path, which can only be symbolized by the miracles of deliverance out of Egypt. But you are ascending in a stoop position under the burden of the law. You come to that ascending passage, it's exactly 33 A.D. on an inch to a year from the marker line back there. It marks dead in history when the Exodus occurred out of Egypt, correcting a lot of erroneous concepts that used to think it was the 12th century. More recent years have proven it, particularly the works of Velikovsky and reading the heathen passages surrounding the same events. And we have the 15th century now as the date, which the pyramid had said for years was the date when they came out of Egypt's bondage. And you count an inch for a year, it comes out exactly to the ascending passage for the death and resurrection of Christ as we extend it through the opening of that blasted out well shaft and from there on upward to the king's chamber. As you enter that first low passageway where you have to stoop again after crossing the great step and march forward horizontal into the king's chamber, you must stoop to go under the first low spot. It opens up into that next antechamber. Then you stoop a second time, go into the king's chamber. You see the little box-like unit at the base of the king's chamber, which is the open coffin therein, which has the same dimensions in sacred cubits as the Ark of the Covenant, and it sat in its original position exactly to the right, because as you enter the king's chamber, it L's to the right, and as you turn to the right to the spot where that open coffin sat, it's exactly 286.1 inches to the right that brings it back into true line and recovers the loss or the sinister movement to the left of the passageway that stayed off-center 286.1 inches. As you come in the king's chamber, you turn right 286.1 inches. You come to the center line of the pyramid, and the coffer used to sit exactly on that line. Now go back to the antechambers. As you go into the king's gallery, as you start the first low point, you come exactly to the month and the day in 1914 that the First World War started. Now, I'll demonstrate this as we go further down the trail in the teaching, but outlined in mathematical precision in the inner passages of this pyramid, as you'll zoom out, is the prophetic outline of the world's history in its downward path to the pit, the ascending passages through the miracle of the custodians of the truth and law, leading up to the point where Christ identified with man's downward path, reversed the displacement back 286.1 inches, and by his death and resurrection, blasted up to the gallery of truth and light, opening up again 286.1 inches to outline the prophetic plan under grace of man's march back toward the king's chamber. And you have a roadmap in scientific precision, not open to interpretations of the meaning of words. Unchanging mathematics verified by the framework of the universe that God created, that lay down a witness of God's control over history that is to stand in the last days as the witness to God's proving up that His word is forever settled in heaven. Now, back to this book. You say, when are you going to do all that? Right away, if I can keep going on it. It's a $40,000 camera that almost fell off there. Even the pyramid cannot dim my sense of value. And that, am I boring you?
No, sir.
The four sides of the pyramid have a combined area of about 20 acres. It has been estimated that at least 144,000 massive limestone blocks were required as casing. In clearing away the debris, it's too cold in here, Mike. In clearing away the debris left by the Turkish vandals who robbed the casing stones for building purposes, quite a large number were found still in their original position along the four baselines. This was very fortunate indeed, for they furnished most valuable information which otherwise would have been lost forever. Professor Petrie, in his account of these stones and the astonishing accuracy of the workmanship which they represent, says the mean thickness of the joints is 1/50th part of an inch. Now, I asked you last night, put the kind of numbers up, phone numbers, to look at the width of those numbers, which is about an inch. Of course, if you're looking on a one-inch television screen, that might not be true. But on my screen, about an inch. Draw an inch on a piece of paper in front of you. And take your pen or your pencil and try to draw 50 lines within that space of an inch. Go ahead. So you can get 50 lines in between the two borders of an inch. You're going to find the 1/50th of an inch is thinner than the width of your pencil or pen line. These 20 to 70,000 ton stones fitted in joints, the widest dimension of which
was a 50th of an inch. That is the mean variation of the cutting of the stone from a straight line. And from the true square, the mean variation of the cutting of the stone from a straight line and from the true square is but 1/100th part of an inch in the length of 75 inches up the face. Now cut 75 inches with the mean variation, because you're on each side, you've got to have, when you're left and the cutter's out, there's only a 50th of an inch between them. So you've got to cut 75 inches and never vary more than 1/100th of an inch. Try to put 100 lines in an inch. This is a degree of accuracy equal to most modern opticians' straight edges of such length. These joints, with an area of some 35 square feet each, were not only worked as finely as this, just described, but were cemented throughout, pouring the cement in that narrow 1/50th of an inch maximum variation vertical with a perfect consistency of cementing 35 square feet each poured vertical in a space 1/50th inch apart and 70,000 to 20,000 ton stones. Pretty good stone axe work for those Stone Age people. Though the stones were brought as close as 1/500th part of an inch, or in fact into contact, and the mean opening of the joint was but 1/50th part of an inch, yet the builders managed to fill the joint with cement in spite of the area of it and the weight of the stones to be moved. Merely to place such stones in exact contact would be careful work, but to do so with cement in the joints seems almost impossible. Stone Age men out throwing stones around. You want me to continue?
Yes,
we're on the telephone. Talking about the precision of the work on the Pyramid of Egypt, the mathematical genius it took, as well as the mechanical genius to build it, and all that done some 4,000 to 5,000 years ago at least. And I just read from Professor Petrie's account concerning the giant stones that were joined together that the mean thickness of the joints between the stones is 1/50th part of an inch. Try to break an inch into 50 parts. And the mean variation of the cutting of the stone from a straight line and from the true square is but 1/100th part of an inch and the length of 75 inches up the face. That's optical precision. Cemented at the same time. Their almost superhuman skill in fixing in position and cementing the joints of such immense stones is indeed difficult to understand. How, in the casing of the Great Pyramid, they could fill with cement a vertical joint or joinder about 5 feet by 7 feet in area with surfaces no more than 1/50th of an inch apart, thus practically in contact, is a mystery. More especially as the joint could not be thinned by rubbing, owing to its being a vertical joint and the block weighing 20 tons. Yet this was the usual work over 20 acres of surface with tens of thousands of casing stones, none less than a ton in weight. So fine and practically invisible are the joints that are cemented the stones together that unless marked in black, the camera will not show them. Men of these modern times who have spent their lives working stone do not know how the builders of the pyramid obtained an accuracy of cut and finish impossible in masonry work today and found only in the most skilled of optical achievement. Whether the face to be leveled was cut square or angular, the finished work on all the stones was practically perfect, a feat beyond present Masonic ability of the most skilled type. Another important fact about the casing stones was that they were not merely triangular in shape, but cut so that they extended back fully 2 feet under the casing stone above. This gave each block 6 sides rather than 5 and sealed the pyramid perfectly against such disintegration, which might result from rain and sand being blown behind the casing, or a flood that's going to cover the earth. I'm warning you. To true north, a difficult task in itself. It was built in dimensions that mathematically and architecturally permanized the concept of pi, by which the circumference of a circle can be maintained. Its external dimensions permanized the 3 years, the solar year, which is the basis of our normal calendar, the sidereal year, and the anomalistic year. It permanized in its measuring unit a knowledge of the distance now capable of being measured with fancy scientific instruments, the distance from the north to the south pole through the axis of the earth. And we, via the English, still have the inch that is just a half a hair's breadth off from that original pyramid inch, which permanized that unit of measurement 1/500,000,000th of the distance from the north to the south pole, which said unit of measurement enables the measuring of the universe. It permanizes in its mathematical architecture the distance from the earth to the sun, and it is in four-sided pyramid shape, a transference of the top half of a circle into a pyramid analogy, and thus it perfectly contains in its dimensions the top half of the earth and is meant to show forth the knowledge of those facts. Now, we've had a fight since we inherit that same sacred unit of measure that's built into the universe from Egypt through England to America, and there's been a resistance to all attempts to change us to the metric system, much less accurate. The French Revolution devised at the time the metric system, and that basic unit of measurement, the meter, was taken to represent a 10,000,000th part. Come over here. The 10,000,000th part of the mean distance from either of the Earth's poles to its center. to the equator. Or wait till the camera gets on it. The metric system is based upon a 10 millionth part of the distance from the North Pole to the center of the Earth at the equator, whether going from one pole to the other, measured round the Earth's surface. That's the basis of the metric system. 1/10 millionth of the distance from pole to equator. This distance is almost impossible to ascertain accurately because the Earth's not a true sphere. The mathematician Colette observed in 1795, a more scientific standard of measure would have been the 10 millionth part of the direct distance from the pole to the center of the Earth. Of course, we advanced scientists at the time this was being fought out, in the liberating time of the French Revolution, to know how to measure it with absolute precision through the center of the Earth. It takes modern scientific instruments to do that. But the mathematician recognized that would be a more accurate measurement unit. In the course of the geodetic research undertaken during the International Geophysical Year in 1957-58, observation of the orbits of Earth's satellites established that the Earth's mean polar radius was 3949.89 miles, a distance equal to 250,000 or rather 250,265,030.4 British inches. The ideal metric unit equal to a 10 millionth of this distance would therefore equal 25.0265 British inches. This very measurement is found 3 times, correct to 4 decimal places, inside the Great Pyramid. And now we know the British inch being 1/10,011th of an inch off, half a hair's breadth, that the pyramid inch exactly is 1/500 millionth of the full distance from North to South Pole. The pyramid builders knew these dimensions, and we had to float satellites to figure it out. They must have wound up and thrown the head off their axe into orbit in very accurate ways, those poor Stone Age people upon whom we are an improvement. Too hot in here, Mike. Now, I teach to simply demonstrate the biblical view of the process of mankind's history is more accurate than that which has been derived from the evolutionary theory. I have no quarrel with evolution. But it does not set the norm of man's history. The biblical shows a man much brighter and more advanced, who lost his position through cataclysm, started over again, degenerated greatly, and only now is beginning to climb back. Not some straight line progressive improvement of man from Stone Age to the present. The Bible speaks of a man that started out better than we are, who degenerated, and now the path is leading back. One or the other is right. The pyramid suggests the Stone Age man tradition would have us believe we descended from couldn't build this. Indeed, modern man couldn't build this. So somebody back there was awful smart. Who? And why this pyramid with all this building into itself, this demonstration of mathematical and astronomical genius? It gets attention. That's just the packaging. That becomes the verifier of the wisdom of the one who built it, whose plan or designed it, whose plan was to have this packaging, by its very nature verifying the genius of the builder, give credibility to the message contained inside. His resurrection of Christ beyond the natural verifies, as Paul said to those on Mars Hill, the ordination of Christ as God's Son. The very scientific marvel of the pyramid is attention getting to a message contained therein that a scientific age whose attention has been gotten can be instructed from. This is a scientific age. The scientific age that's supposed to explain God out of the universe. And is God so stupid he couldn't anticipate this age and have an unequivocal message in stone that would bear witness to him, to this age? I'm now reading from the book I was reading on last night. It can be conclusively demonstrated that the postulated measurements and listed correlations all inherent in the pyramid design were put there by a designer who was aware of those astronomical facts, a knowledge beyond what tradition says ancient man should have had, which of course immediately poses problems for historians. If, after all, we assume that the inclusion in the pyramid's design of the data we've been talking about for two nights, and that only scratches the surface, was not fortuitous or accidental, and there seems to be little alternative to denying that, it wasn't an accident, that much accuracy, then we're virtually admitting that the degree of scientific knowledge exhibited by the pyramid's designer is completely incompatible with what current historical theory tells us about man's early history. Such is the divide between fact and theory that many writers on the pyramid have found it necessary to assume that the pyramid was designed by none other than the deity. A time-honored argument for explaining anything one cannot understand. And one that the scientific mind most reluctantly wants to even consider. For that reason. But in this case, there's no better theory. And at least one has to conclude that human history is not, after all, what we have so often been given to believe. A long, slow, upward gradient leading inexorably from primitive man to the summit of modern society's achievements. Instead, it would appear to consist of at least two and possibly many more such upward gradients, each followed by a sudden collapse and recommencement. The idea seems fantastic, but on what other basis can one explain the equally fantastic evidence of the Great Pyramid's technology and the apparent knowledge of its architect? Almost the only alternative would seem to be von Daniken's controversial postulation of men or beings from another world. What? That ain't so far out. The Bible speaks of beings from another world, who impregnated the women of this earth before the flood and created all kinds of problems leading up to God's destruction. Of course, Nobody's supposed to believe the Bible. And those who believe it the least are Christians. To what purpose is all this waste of scientific knowledge encased in stone? Why should a member of some primeval but advanced civilization, apparently realizing that he and his contemporaries were on the brink of some cataclysm, if we accept the hypothesis or the statement of Josephus that descendants of Seth before the flood who received knowledge of a great cataclysm, encased the knowledge to preserve that cataclysm in two places, in stone in Mesopotamia, or rather in brick in Mesopotamia, and in stone in the land of Egypt, which Josephus in the first century says, the brick one was destroyed, and the one of stone in Egypt still remained to his day. Why should a member of some primeval but advanced civilization, like those Sethites, as one example, apparently realizing that he and his contemporaries were on the brink of some cataclysm, decided to draw up plans for the erection of what would appear to be little more than a monument of witness. A colossal expenditure of time and effort undertaken evidently for no more useful purpose than to demonstrate to future men that others had been there before them. They were smart. I'm warning you. Seen in this light, the pyramid can only be regarded as a rather pointless example of historical boasting. We won't be there when you find it, but we were smart. So it may seem until one starts to examine other possible motives for such a decision. And then it starts to become apparent that what we've termed historical boasting is in fact a fairly unlikely explanation. The whole thing seems to have been much too carefully planned and premeditated, and to have involved far too much expenditure of time and materials to permit us to accept so superficial a motivation. It seems likely that the designer had some much more serious purpose in view when he finally drew up the plans for the construction of the mighty edifice. But what serious purpose? Who was he? What could have been the circumstances that spurred him on? Who cares? You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Well, it's too cold in here, number one. There's not enough of you talking on the telephone during the musical break. And if I don't see a better performance during this song, it's bye-bye. I'll go home, meditate on this myself, and have pyramid dreams. So get on telephone.